Hey there, it's Michaela LaFrac. Heads up that we've edited this podcast episode a little bit for you. Skimmed the fat, boiled it down. Hope you enjoy. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Julia Alvarez has had a remarkable life and career, from growing up in a tight-knit community in the Dominican Republic to fleeing the dictatorship of Rafael Trujillo with her family to becoming an award-winning writer and trailblazer for other Latino authors. A new PBS documentary out this week documents her story. It's called Julia Alvarez, A Life Reimagined. I recently had the opportunity to sit down with Julia Alvarez in front of a live audience at the Town Hall Theater in Middlebury. It was a hometown crowd for her. She and her husband live right nearby. It was a free event as well, an opportunity that was made possible by Vermont Public members. This hour, we are going to share that conversation with you. I'm so excited for you to listen. So let's dive in.
One of the things your sister, one of your sisters said early on in the film really stuck with me. It said that you were always in search of two things, and one of them was space, physical and emotional space. I'm curious if you agree with that and what that space looks like in your life. Have you found it?
Well, it's one of the things Anna says that I agree with. Yes, I think, you know, we were three girls 11 months apart. And so that we wouldn't fight or argue about who got what, mommy would buy the same outfit or make it there in the DR. I had all these tias that sewed, but in different colors. So Maori was yellow, I was red, Tita was blue, and then the baby came and she, Anna, and she wanted pink, which I considered part of my red.
It's part of red.
Domain. So that started the difficulties with the little sister. But so there was no space. It was, you know, middle child squeezed in. And we always had to, especially when we came to the States, we were all sharing a room together. I just really wanted solitude. And, you know, that translated to space, especially as a writer. You need that kind of quiet to integrate things and have time to write. So I think space, I guess I would use a different word, solitude. Mm. I have a huge, I don't have a huge appetite for many things edible, but I do have a huge appetite for solitude. I just feel like I need that because life just comes at you. And as a writer, you know, you're, what is it? Was it? Henry James said, his advice to a writer, be him on whom nothing is lost. So, you know, pay attention. I think writers are paying attention, and that's overwhelming when there's a lot of stimulus. Mm. So the solitude to integrate that and make a narrative or a poem, it's necessary.
Mm. It's interesting you say that because we also saw a scene depicting you at Yaddo, where you were literally locked in a tower in as much solitude as the world could give you, and what you sought out was community and voices.
That's
and storytelling.
Well, to me it was unnerving, imposter syndrome to be there, and trying to sound like the great poets that I had studied, you know, Yeats and Milton and Chaucer and Shakespeare. And it just wasn't my world. And it was back before people had computers. And so you heard the typewriters going all around you. And that's unnerving. And so to finally find a community of people that connected me to something that I needed to connect to the writing. And it was sort of like that Helen Keller movie where she has her hand and they're
pumping the water
and she suddenly gets that sign language, mm-hmm. that means this. You know, it was sort of like, oh, it was, this can go with this. And I had never seen anybody write about the things that I knew about. And I even remember at college having, writing a poem, and I had a Tia Rosa, and it was circled and said, well, this is, what does this mean? And I said, oh, it's my aunt, Rosa. Well, say Aunt Rose. But the poem fell apart when I put an Aunt Rose in there instead of a Tia Rosa. So I wasn't making those connections. And there weren't models out there. There weren't multicultural writers. There weren't Latina writers out there. So, you know, they talk about a multicultural curriculum. It's not because you want to be PC. It's because you need to see yourself reflected to know that you also belong on that page, on that shelf of American literature. But if you don't see it, and I didn't know that that was possible, I didn't really know it until Maxine Haughton Kingston came out with Woman Warrior. Mm. And I thought, oh my goodness, she was writing about a Chinese family, Chinese American, outside of Sacramento, and it could have been my family. You know, the first sentence I always joked, the first sentence of that memoir could have been the first sentence of any Latina writer. It starts out with, my mother told me never ever to repeat this story. And then she tells it. And as you heard,
you got in trouble for that.
Yep.
Is that a lesson that you learned while you were teaching at your old school or afterwards? I learned in this film that you went back to the school that you attended,
yes.
Abbott.
Well, it was? It had been absorbed by Andover then.
Mm, okay.
And so I was teaching there. That was my first teaching job that wasn't like a six-week gig with poets in the schools or, you know, these little writing workshops that I would give around the country. So it was the first regular paycheck. Yeah, no, I was already beginning to write. I had already been to Yaddo.
Were you teaching the canon at that time?
Absolutely.
Or were you starting to say, hey, here's a voice
absolutely.
I can speak in?
Because they gave you the reading list. You taught the curriculum, the great books. So there wasn't much leeway there. And the great thing about doing creative writing workshops is that then you could bring examples of something else. But that was the only, you know, freedom in terms of choosing a curriculum. Mm.
I would love to hear, if you're willing to share, a little bit more about your time at Abbott as a student. I can't imagine what the change in pace was like from growing up in the DR to being at this rather prestigious school
exactly.
in Massachusetts.
Right.
What was that like?
My sister and I got scholarships to Abbott, and we got this list. They came to Queens with all the things that we were to bring to school. And I still remember that we didn't know what some of the things were. Like, it said 3 tea dresses. And we didn't know what that was. So there was, I don't know if you remember those old, I don't think there's any more that they exist anymore, Gertz and Mays, these department stores. They weren't fancy ones like Bloomingdale's or Saks. Mm-hmm. So my mother went with a list and showed it to the salesperson there and said, what is a tea dress? They didn't know what a tea dress was. And so it was a little, you know, we went there and we had, you know, colorful clothes that the tias had made us. Yeah. And we did not look like we belonged there. And so slowly we learned about this culture of Abbott, but the nice thing was that I had some wonderful English teachers. They were passionate, and I'm still in touch. Well, one of them passed away, but still in touch with the other one, and they got me started writing. You know, they really encouraged me. So that was my salvation at Abbott, that I got really involved in the writing. And some of the women there that we now get together once every few years on our own. There are about 40 of us. And I really love these women. They have become something else. And we talk about, you know, how awkward that all was. You know, we didn't feel like we had the right clothes. We didn't know any of the references that were talked about. So it was a hard landing, you know, 14 years old at Abbott Academy. But then we got corrupted. And that created another kind of problem, right? I mean, we landed in the 60s. This was the 60s. You know, the youth were going wild. Our friends were. And suddenly, worlds were opening that would not have been allowed back home, where we were chaperoned and, you know, strictly raised by a very conservative family. Mm-hmm. So it was a real eye-opener.
Hmm. I believe you called it the golden cage, a
gilded
cage.
Oh, when we went back.
Yeah.
And see, I shouldn't have been the one going to be presented to society because I wasn't the oldest. Mm. And my sister said, dream on, to my father. She was a bigger hippie than I. But I was already a writer, and I wanted to go back and see what it was like. Mm. So I went. And, you know, had my hair done at the salon and a gown put on and learn how to waltz. Because, of course, we couldn't dance merengue. Because also that's something in the culture. It's really changed now. But aping the European, you know. And so at a society ball, of course, you couldn't dance merengues or boleros. You danced waltzes. So that's why we slipped out of the presentation ball and headed for the town to the little barra where we could dance merengue and hang out. But I wanted that. I wanted to experience what it was like. Mm. So that's why I ended up being the one being presented.
Mm. How long did you stay there during that trip?
All summer.
All summer.
Yeah, all summer.
Did you ever consider
staying? I had to learn how to waltz.
Takes a while. Did you ever consider staying longer, or were you ready to come back?
You know, every time I would go back, I would think, every time life here wasn't working, there were a lot of hard knocks here and making big mistakes, as you heard from my sister. Did she ever write about marriages? I don't think they've read my books. So every time it would crash, I would think, I'm going back. That's where real happiness lies, and all I needed was to go back and feel the world closing in on what a woman could and couldn't do, and I would say, no, I don't belong here. And yet I was a hybrid, and that was difficult because it was the either-or era of, you know, you were either an American or a Dominican. Now, and I realized that, you don't have to choose. You can be whatever mixture you are, you know. So, but again, the culture wasn't there. So I didn't even have this vocabulary to talk about what I was feeling. I just felt confused because all the cousins in the DR were in marriages and having their children and their households. And my writer friends were getting on and publishing, and I just didn't feel like, you know, every 6 weeks I would pack up my little yellow VW and head for the next place to teach poetry workshops.
You must have seen a lot of America.
I was like Whitman. I saw America. I really did, and I love that part. I ended up in North Carolina at one gig teaching senior citizens in what were called sunshine centers. African American churches would have these things called sunshine, like our Project Independence, right? And so they wanted me to come and teach a poetry workshop. So I appear with all these lesson plans, and most of the elderly African Americans there did not know how to read or write. But why did they show up in my poetry workshop? Because they had told them that there was a lady from the government, it was National Endowment for the Arts, Poetry in the Schools, was coming in, and she was going to teach about poultry. Poetry, Southern accent, poultry. So they were all there expecting to learn from me how to do their chickens. They would tell stories, and I would write them down, and we put together a little anthology called Old Age Ain't for Sissies. Mm. It was wonderful, wonderful experience. But yeah, poultry workshops.
I have to ask a bit about your relationship with your sisters. I'm one of five daughters.
Oh,
so
my
I get
goodness.
It
Which number
bit.
Are you?
I'm the fifth.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So you're the baby.
I'm the baby. I know.
Yeah, you get a little space
My
at
life
the
was
end.
Hard, too.
Write a book about it.
I was very spoiled.
And call it fiction, I'll tell you.
I'm curious if your relationship with your sisters, how it changed from when you were young children, all growing up together in the, you know, matching, almost matching color-coded outfits. When you started to feel like you were diverging, you were becoming your own person, you were going down a very different path. When did that happen?
Well, I think I always loved stories growing up. Kids love to hear that I flunked every grade through fifth grade in the Dominican Republic because it was a dictatorship school. Everything was by rote. Ah. There were no interesting books. They were all official dogma. And so I was bored. And so I didn't pay attention. And so every once in a while, something would come back to home saying, Julia does not pay attention. But when I got home and somebody said, ven acá, let me tell you a story, I would be there. Tell me again. Tell it again. Tell it. I didn't have problems paying attention, but I was not a reader. I hated school. I hated books. But then we landed in the United States, and it was not very friendly or welcoming in the school we were sent to. Part of the reason Mother tried to get us at Abbott, we had a lot of incidents, and the only safe space was between the covers of books. And again, wonderful teachers, Catholic school, the sisters, they could tell that I was there, you know, eager to hear when they would tell stories. And they somehow, again, convinced me, because I didn't want to read, that between the covers of some books were stories as good as the oral culture I had come from. And they were written down, so you didn't have to wait till your auntie was in a good mood to tell you a story. You didn't have to get scolded because you would say, tell it again. And it was, I became a reader. And the library, my goodness, the library. I thought it was a cathedral for books. And after a while, you're listening to all these stories. You're in the big circle of storytellers. And you realize something's missing, the story that you can tell. And so you start wanting to be part of what Langston Hughes in that poem, I Too Sing America. You know, he was sent to the kitchen of minor writers, and he wanted to be at the big table of American literature. Mm. And I got that ambition in me that I wanted to be part of that big circle. And at the beginning, my sisters loved that I was a writer because I wrote poetry, and nobody reads poetry. You know? And so it didn't get me in trouble at all. And I did get me in trouble because we shared a bedroom, and at night, any poem I liked, I would memorize from the oral culture. And in the dark, once the lights were mandatory off, Mommy would check, close the door, I would start reciting all the poems that I knew. And they would go, Mommy, she's doing it again! And Mommy would come and said, would tell me to keep it to myself. I have a poem about that. So they loved the fact that I was a poet, and they quoted my lines back to me. But when I started writing stories that were not, they were not about the family, they were fictionalized, and you know, the way that you take details, material of your own life, and you mold a story out of it. But there was enough resemblance that, yeah, it ruffled some feathers. Mm. And I had a hard time for several years because of my writing. And so now I write, and if I don't send them the new book with a gorgeous, loving dedication, they get pissed off at me. And if I send it with a note, please don't read this, then they want to read it. So there's no way to win, but they're still, you know, we're sisters. We're in it together. Mm. And I know they'll show up and take my bullet if they have to, but, you know, but not just mine. The bullet, yes, but not the novels.
Well, we'll talk more offline about the drama of sisters. I think we have some stories to share. Yeah. I'm curious to hear more about how you think about class and how you look back on your childhood.
I was very aware of it even growing up, but I didn't have this language. And I was aware, too, that it was the maids that, when you fell down, picked you up, that held you, that told you stories, even though they got annoyed if you asked for the same one over and over. But so I was aware of class, but it took coming to this country and suddenly not being of the privileged to realize, to live rather than observe that difference. And going to Abbott, you know, where there were very wealthy girls there, and to be aware of the differences there, became very aware of the difference in class. And of course, we had a difficult time as immigrants, but you know, we were white Dominicans, and that made a huge difference because we came in 1960s when the civil rights movement was just getting started. And I remember watching the marches on TV and African Americans getting hosed down, dogs attacking them. And I remember asking Papi about that because they had always told us, but we're going to a free country. Everybody's free there. We'll have our... Well, they didn't tell us that, but when we landed and we were homesick and wanted to go back, they'd say, but we're in the land of freedom. Turn on the TV. And I thought, wait a minute, this is not the promise. This is like the dictatorship. But somehow, because you can get by, because you're white or light-skinned, you have privilege, and that was a discomfort too, you know, the sense of race here and the difference. Had we come with a later wave of Dominicans that came up to Washington Heights? Well, first of all, they had a community. We didn't. But it was, they experienced. I have friends that came up from the DR, and they said, we didn't know we were black till we came to this country because, you know, the one drop rule and the fact that they were treated differently. And though we have a lot of colorism in the DR, don't get me wrong, but there's somehow, even within a family, there's mixtures. So it isn't something that you're going to told to sit in the back of the bus. If you're the old auntie, you sit in the front because you're elder, you know, even if you're dark skinned. But that wasn't the experience that I was seeing here. So it was confusing. It was a confusing.
Do you think that was hard for your mother, those changes in class that you brought up?
I think she had the hardest time because we were still kids and acclimated.
Yeah.
And Papi didn't have a job at first and was just whatever he could pick up, you know, whatever laboring job he could pick up till he studied and learned enough English to pass his license exam. And then he didn't choose to do a fancy practice. He went to Brooklyn when Brooklyn was Brooklyn, to Bushwick, and there was a Latino community there, and that's where he worked. So he found his little community. Mommy was hard. You know, she had been raised very privileged, and she was used to having a lot of help and a very powerful family around her, and she had to change. And, you know, to her credit, my sisters and I say we raised Mommy once we got to this country. I mean, Mommy got involved in the UN, in the Third Committee, worked for the rights of elders and women's rights and children. She marched with the Gray Panthers in New York City. Mommy? So we said, wow, we really brought you up, Mommy, once we got here. And she did get over the whole thing with my writing and became my biggest advocate when she was at the UN giving out copies, not of Garcia Girls, but in the Time of the Butterflies. That was safer territory for her.
How did that shift happen with you two? Was it gradual, or did you have a big sit down, let it all out?
No, when someone's not talking to you, that's kind of hard. Mm-hmm. I think slowly seeing people read me, and they'd come up to her at the UN and say, "You must be so proud." And I think she gave it another thought, because she thought that my writing about wild girls reflected poorly on her mothering and her family. And come to find out that, you know, people thought the mommy in the book was hilarious and wonderful. And so I think she needed a new vocabulary, you know, and she had come, and now I understand this so much better. I mean, I understood it while she was still alive. They had come from a dictatorship where to tell any story could get you and your family arrested, tortured, maybe killed, disappeared. And you can leave the dictatorship, but it was still in their heads. And I think that sort of silence and censorship that came from her family, but also above that, the dictatorship, it took shifting inside her to realize that it was okay, you know, and that she was safe. And so I think it was a shift that happened over time. But it makes me understand very much the different generations of an immigrant family. You know, the ones who come, they're in their 40s, and it's hard to rewire yourself at that age. And then they have kids who are going to school, picking up things that the parents don't feel are right or aren't comfortable with. And then the next generation comes, and they want to find out all about their Latina roots, you know. So there's all these gradations of that immigration that go on. But I think it was difficult, especially for her.
You write primarily, of course, in English. Did you ever write in Spanish, poetry or prose?
As I said, I write my Spanish and English because we came before bilingual education, where our dear sisters, nuns, would scold us and punish us if they caught us speaking in Spanish in the playground. Yeah. So there was this push to learn your English. And parents, immigrant parents, want you to succeed, want you to fit in, want you to lose your accent. And so there was that push. So as a result, I'm very sad about it. Yeah. I never mastered my native tongue. I have oral Spanish. I can speak it, but I call it childhood Spanish. I couldn't talk like this and think as I talk in Spanish. I never had that training. And when my novels or stories are translated into Spanish, I'm sent the translation because I couldn't do it myself. And I can read it, and I can say, it doesn't sound right, but I can't tell them how to fix it. I drive the translators crazy because I know it doesn't sound right, but I haven't learned to craft the language the way I've had the training in English. I have the story where once I was on a book tour, and during the Q&A, this man at the back of the room said, "When are you going to write shorter sentences?" I thought, wow, what a question. And I thought, So I went back to the hotel, and I had Raymond Carver on my book tour because it was a skinny little book, easy to carry. And I went, and I actually counted the number of words in each sentence. And then I graphed it like an electrocardiogram. And he was pretty steady in this range, you know, 4, 5, 10, long sentence, maybe 12. Then I went through In the Time of the Butterflies. I had 48, 12, 5, 76. You know, I thought, wow, you know, it's just the rococo nature of the Spanish was coming through in English. But I didn't realize that till I was asked when I was going to write shorter sentences.
Do you remember what you responded?
I didn't know what to say because I hadn't counted them before.
Now you have data.
Yeah. What?
Now you have data.
You know. Yeah, that's funny. I can't remember what I said. It's probably because of our training from mommy. Thank you. I was probably polite and gracious.
Hmm. Where do you write?
In solitude. I have friends, some of them might even be in this audience, who go to coffee shops to write. I could not. I'd be paying attention. Good old Henry James, paying attention. I could not write. So I write in solitude. I have a room that I write in that when they filmed it, I wouldn't let them go in there. So it's sort of a stage set. When you saw me writing, I wasn't really in my studio. I don't allow any, if I've won a prize and I have a little trophy, none of that is allowed in the room. I have to remember each time I sit down to write that I have to learn to write what I'm writing then, and the other stuff doesn't matter. Beginner's mind, as the Zen say. I have to start over. And you can't say, well, I wrote a good poem before. There's no guarantees. It's unnerving, but it's part of the excitement and what is it, Yeats? Here I am quoting the masters. The fascination of what's difficult, he calls it. You know, it's just, there's a fascination with it. And so I write in that studio and I try not to do, you know, one of the worst things that has happened is the internet. It's great for research, but it's like, your distraction is in the same instrument you're writing in, so that it's as if you were playing the cello and it would flash with a little message on your cello and distract you. So you're sitting on your screen and you're full into what you're writing, and all of a sudden, I have learned to turn off notifications. But there's also, you know, when it's so hard, it's so easy to then turn it on, get a few things done on the computer, and then you're lost because you've lost, you've woken up from the narrative dream that you were in, you know, and it takes a while to get back. So I try to stay off the email, the phone. Mommy, again, after a while, she knew that you couldn't call Julia to just gab until after 3, when her writing day was over. And she would get so mad. She would say, well, what about if I die before 3? I said, Mother, this is why we sparked. I said, Mother, you're welcome to die anytime you want, but have them call me after 3. You can see why there were sparks.
You are a braver daughter than I am.
She said I was the best of the 4 girls ever until I learned to talk.
The last time you and I spoke, you were a guest on Vermont Edition. We were talking about your book, The Cemetery of Untold Stories. Mm. And in that book, if you haven't read it, which you should, it's amazing. A woman travels back to the Dominican Republic with a physical box of stories, unfinished stories. We've talked so much about your family tonight. I'm curious if you still have stories of your family, inspired by your family, left to tell, that you want to tell.
Well, you know, a lot of the stories, too, are... I mean, I've written historical fiction in the time of the butterflies, In the Name of Salome, Saving the World. All those are, you know, they're not just based on my family. Yes. And Afterlife is based on my hometown. And Town Hall Theater makes an appearance in there. So I do write, but, you know, there's so many stories, and the inspiration, although I don't really, I call it, I highfalutin. It sounds highfalutin to talk about inspiration. I call it the pebble in my shoe, something I can't shake off until I write it. And there's so many things that come to my mind. So many stories. And when I was younger, I would research, and I had drafts, and I have all these boxes. And I would get stuck and I would start something new, but I'd have that several boxes, some finished drafts of novels, poems, and I would say when I was a younger writer, someday I'll get back to this. I promise my characters, someday I will write your story down, but they're still in my head. And now that I'm an old woman, I know I'm not going to get to them at all. And so part of that pebble in my shoe was, what does an older artist do? What is the end? We have the Bildungsroman, the story of the artist, portrait of the artist as a young man. Well, what would it be, the portrait of the writer as an old woman, with the added twist that she's a Latina, whose stories, many of them, have come from somewhere else. So that's where the story got started, of an older writer closing up her writing life, and she has to do justice to these characters and lay them to rest. So she does create a physical cemetery where the stories are told. But like the protest saying, they tried to bury us. They did not know we were seeds. She tried to bury us. She tried to silence us. She did not know we were stories. So the stories all come and start telling their story. So it was a way for me to get to some of the stories that I hadn't finished, or had finished and had never been published through that novel. And I thought it was going to be my last novel.
That's what I was going to ask you about.
Yeah. Well, it was COVID, and there was, all of a sudden, they were talking about us, the vulnerables. it was just a difficult time, and there was so much loss going on, and so much vulnerability. And then, God has a sense of humor. What does the writer lose? Eyesight. So I lost vision in an eye, and the operations didn't work. And then this one started to get flaky. And I thought, I've got to write. Please, just let me write my last novel. And this one is still working. So I'm working on a new novel. That's also my last novel. I don't know if it'll ever finish, because I don't know what kind of visual time is left, but I feel an urgency to get it written. And I feel like I want to go. I want to, when I go and they ring me out, I don't want there to be a drop of story in there. That's what I came here to do, I think.
Julia Alvarez, it has been an honor speaking with you tonight. Thank you.
And thanks. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. They're my home people. They have to do this.
I think it'd be like this.
I paid them to do this. But thank you, Michaela. Thank you, Town Hall Theater. And sorry about the OD on Alvarez. I'm going to shut up for a long time for now.
We're lucky to have you.
Yeah, thank you.
That's it for tonight. We'll see you soon.
Oh, Michaela, you're...
That conversation with the writer Julia Alvarez was recorded earlier this month.